to the Veterinary Financial Podcast, where we discuss financial freedom and professional success. I'm Meredith Jones, a veterinarian and financial planner for vets. Our guest today is Christine Statton. She's a veterinarian, a practice owner, a veterinary business coach, and she has a popular Instagram account called the Veterinary MBA. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Christine, so you wear many hats between running the practice and everything else that you do. I'm really curious about your journey to how you got where you are today. What are the big career steps that have gotten you to where you are now?
Well, I'm going to start way back, and I'm going to admit something that really doesn't fit in the vet world very much. So I think most people who got into vet med probably has a story. Generally involves maybe their dog having parvo when it was a puppy at 5 years old. And that wasn't my story at all. I was an animal kid. I was a 4-H kid. I raised a bunch of different kinds of animals, showed animals, including dogs, horses, bunch of livestock. I was going to be an obstetrician in human medicine. I was going to be a physician. So I was a pre-med student through college. I worked in labor and delivery for 7 years as a technician. And I went to my veterinary school interviews. And they said, why don't you want to be a veterinarian? Or I went to my medical school interviews and they're like, why don't you want to be a veterinarian? And I thought, what a dumb question. Like, why are you asking me that question? So after 7 live interviews, because back then they were all live, I came home and I thought, gosh, I need a better answer to that. And because I'm analytical, I took 2 pieces of paper and I thought, why don't I want to be a veterinarian? And I said, physician, veterinarian, pros and cons, pros and cons. And I literally wrote out the pros and cons of both. I spent a week interviewing veterinarians and interviewing physicians. And then at the end of that week, I actually pulled all my medical school applications and decided to apply to veterinary school. But one of the main reasons, which is here's where the admission comes, is the entrepreneurial side. I knew that I could own a clinic a lot easier in vet med than in human med. And in human med, insurance dictates a lot. Corporate really was all over it. And back then, corporate really wasn't involved in veterinary care. So that was the start of my journey, was my goal was to own a practice. So my first practice that I joined was My Vet, who was ambulatory only, mixed animal, and she'd been alone, no employees for 20 years. And I joined and I told her that I wanted a path to practice ownership from day one. 5 years. And within 3 years, I bought into the practice. So that's the start of my journey. And then my vision was always to grow the practice, to actually hire employees because we didn't have any, and have a brick and mortar.
Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea that they asked that question in med school interviews.
Well, I think it was because of my application. My application was so heavy animal based that it was so obvious afterwards. To me, like, this was clearly where I was supposed to be.
Cool. So next I'm going to ask you about just something that I think more practice owners and business owners in general should be doing that I know you do a lot of and talk about. So what is your approach to strategic planning at your practice?
Yeah, it is very intensive and very, very helpful. So what we do at our practice is our management team goes away for 3 days. We physically go away from the clinic. We've learned that we have to go at least 4 hours from the clinic for this to be effective. Otherwise, we'll just come back if there's a problem. And we spend those 3 days very purposely going over day one is where are you now? Day two is where do you want to be? And day three is how do we get there? And how do we know we've arrived? When we do that, we have a ton of prep ahead of time, which involves our team all gets a 27-page survey that they all fill out. We collect client data. We collect financial data. We basically have everything we need to be able to say, where are we now? And have some objective and subjective criteria and really a lot of input from our team and our clients as to where we are now. And then day two, same thing, input from the team. Oh, this is a problem. What's the solution that you suggest? So there's a lot of prep work that goes into it, but we come back with an action plan with a vision for the next 12 months, and then we break it up into 12 weeks. And we have a vision beyond 12 months, but we don't spend a ton of time on that. Because 2020 just rocked us all. Doesn't matter what our plans were, we all got knocked off of them. I'm not going to put a ton of energy into the 5 and 10 year goals. We know them. Then we meet every 12 weeks, a full day. The whole management team meets for a full day of 12 weeks strategic planning to say, how are we doing? What do we need to shift for the next 12 weeks? Makes it more bite-sized to do it that way. And it's literally propelled us to every goal that we wanted and beyond. So if we have a goal, even if it's insanely lofty and doesn't make any sense, we're going to get there because we have a plan to get there.
Let me ask you this. How many practices do you think do what you guys do and have a strategic planning meeting every 12 weeks?
Not the ones that come to me for help. I made a whole workshop on how to do this. And a lot of people, I think, are doing it that I talk to from that. No, I think people are afraid to leave their practice for 3 days. And I think those are the practices, those are the owners that need to strategically plan. How are they going to make the practice less dependent upon them? One of our big goals that I'm just so proud of, I'm bursting at the seams, because next week, our in-clinic childcare center opens for my team. And this has been a dream since I opened a practice. I have 5 kids, but what we've seen on our end, just from a pure ROI standpoint, which is not the whole reason we built it, but from a pure ROI standpoint, is I lose my technicians when they have that second baby. And we are family friendly, and we want to encourage people to have the family that they want to have. And when they have that second baby, either they can't afford the daycare because the money doesn't work, or their parents that were watching the kiddo now is like, I'm not watching 2 kids. So I've lost a lot of amazing technicians. And so has the veterinary industry, because we just didn't have a place for them. And I can't change their wages significant enough based on all the crunch and the numbers. So what can I do to reduce their household income so that we can keep them working in the profession that they love? And so that was just a strategic plan. And we said, how do we get there? And we worked really hard to get there. And it opens next week.
Wow, that's so exciting. Yeah, congratulations for getting that done. I'm sure that took a lot of planning. So
yeah, I'm very excited.
Is there any specific framework, like the one in the book Traction, or you know, any specific framework that you use for strategic planning?
Nope, just our own. Like, I have a really detailed agenda, but I think the framework is, where are we now? Like we talked about, like, give me the data, give me what's working, what's not working. What do we need to keep doing? What do we need to stop doing? What do we need to start doing? Those are the questions we're asking our team. We ask them about the hiring process. We ask them about the onboarding and orientation if they're new to us this year. So we're asking them a lot of things so that we can get input, so we can say, hey, our onboarding is working great. Everyone's happy about it. Don't touch it. That's something we don't have to work on. Oh, but our hiring process is a little wonky. Like, we need to speed it up. Everyone, you know, we lost a few good people because they took another job while waiting for us to get back to them. Okay, let's fix that. So then day two, we talk about all the fixes. What do we want to fix? What do we want to change? What do we want to do differently? What do we need to do to get to our lofty goals? And then day three is the reality check. Okay, we want to do all this. How do we do that? Can we do it all this year? Are there things that we mentioned on day two that we're just not going to do this year because we're realistic about it? And then that just turns into literally a task list of actions that all start with a verb, right? And are not working on or looking into. We're going to do this. This is what we're going to do. And then we assign those to each manager, has one that they're responsible for. But there's team members in the clinic that might take that task on. That person we assign it to is just the one that's going to be responsible for making sure it gets done. And it works. And everyone's empowered by it because it's their suggestions. We're working off of their suggestions. So we don't have a lot of barriers to implementation for the changes that we're making because they're coming from the people who are doing the stuff.
Yeah, I love that. So you've got your own framework that you use. So you do coaching, you have courses that you run, workshops that you run. What are some of the most common, or I guess just one, what's one of the most common pain points you hear about from practice owners?
So I don't think they say it right away, but it's isolation. They really feel alone. They're surrounded by people every day, but no one there actually gets the immense responsibility and burdens that they carry. And I think it's okay. Your team shouldn't know all that stuff. It's not important that they know all of it. And having to keep that inside and just kind of work through it personally and alone, I think is the biggest thing. I think community, when we get to talk to one other practice owner, automatically we have that in common. And it's not in common with anyone in our building. Honestly, it's not in common with our spouse. We love our spouses, but they don't feel the weight as much as we do. Our friends certainly don't. We have to find community with other practice owners. And that's why live conferences and even Zoom meetings with practice owners just really are the fuel to, okay, I can do this. I'm not alone in this.
It's lonely at the top, they say.
Yeah. I feel like this is just my description of it, but I have right now 47 team members. The decisions I make affect 50 electric bills, my house, my two clinics, and 47 other people's electric bills. If I screw this up royally by making a major poor decision and we are not sustainable anymore, people don't have jobs. That's the stuff that makes me sweat at 2 a.m. sometimes when I'm making big decisions. And that doesn't need to go into my clinic. They don't need to know that. But boy, it helps when I'm sitting next to somebody else who's felt that or is currently feeling that.
Yeah. Wow. That is a common pain point. What's one of the biggest mistakes you see practice owners making, practice owners that you either work with or interact with in your community?
Well, I make it too. Everything that I coach on is because I did it wrong 20 times and I just don't want people to hit the potholes and speed bumps. I'm actually in the process of having the same problem that a lot of people have. I think it's outsourcing and delegating. I think it's empowering your team. I think it's realizing that other people can do it better, or if they can't do it better than you, if they're doing it 80% as well as you, and it's not something you have to worry about, let it go. You can let it go. That is a hard barrier to do. And sometimes the problem is delegating something out is a process and you can't just dump it on someone. And so when you're really busy and you're in the thick of it and it's crazy and you're like, I don't have time to teach somebody else how to do it. My joke is we had five kids and I would tell my husband would say, it's easier to load the dishwasher than teach the kids how to load the dishwasher right. And I think we have to back way up and say, okay, I have to carve out time to pass this off to somebody else. I have to, even though I'm in chaos. I'm doing that right now. I'm hiring an assistant that's going to help me just turn stuff in on time for my speaking opportunities, because they're like, we need the proceedings. We need your learning objectives. We need multiple choice questions. And I'm like, what is this? I have 9 speaking engagements between now and the end of the year. But passing that off is going to take more effort than doing it myself. But I know long-term it's the right decision. I think that's really hard to explain to somebody that's tired and exhausted that they have to put in more work before they actually get the reward.
Yeah, it really is. Because it's like, oh, I want to delegate this, but now I'm going to have to do the training and I could just do it myself, but then I'm always going to have to do it myself.
Yeah. And that's just a common problem. It has nothing to do with practice owners in veterinary medicine. Managers deal with this too, with middle management. And certainly every human in the world deals with this in whatever capacity that is, whether it's dishwashers or payroll.
Yeah. And sometimes we've had a couple of episodes about perfectionism on this podcast. And do you think veterinarians have a harder time delegating because we're, you know, either like type A or we just want it done 80% might not be good enough for that sort of thing?
I think all entrepreneurs are, most are. I think personality types fit into this, right? And I do think that comes back to that it's all on me feeling like, oh, this is a risk to pass this off to somebody else, right? But there's so many things that aren't risky to pass off. Start with those and then start to gain trust. And then I'm not afraid of the word micromanage. I think it can be meaning a lot of things, but certainly I should be double checking if it's a big deal. We're doing a huge thing right now with a credit card swap. I'm not doing it like our credit card merchant stuff. And we're going to be passing the fees on to the client. So we need to really have good communication there. We've got to get all these systems set up. I'm doing none of that, but I'm involved and they're giving me weekly updates. And I'm checking to see and giving my opinion on certain things and even saying, nope, I'd rather have this here and that there. So I think you can still be involved in those huge things, but it is risky, you know, it's risky to pass it off.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's talk about aspiring practice owners. Do you work with, because I know you work with a lot of practice owners for sure through your coaching and coursework. Do you also have aspiring practice owners contact you and what sort of advice are they looking for?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I started this, I was going to help other practice owners not hit all the potholes and speed bumps I did. Like that was my only goal. But I realized very quickly a few things. One, practices that are larger that have management, they need a lot of the help. So I started helping managers. And then I did little surveys say, who's following me on Instagram? A bunch of people who want to be. There were tons of associate veterinarians and tons of student vets. And I thought, well, why the heck are they at this account? I only talk about practice ownership. So yes, I actually brought that in. I thought, I need to make some courses about this. And Path to Practice Ownership became kind of my signature thing that I do. It's just modules on how to start a practice. But I had a mastermind on it. So it's become a huge part of what I do. And I love it because I think that we should have more practice owners. Like, I just feel like it's such a great industry. Like, our failure rate is like 0.03%, I think, for failure rate.
Super low.
Nothing else we do in life has a failure rate that low. Yes, people should own it. So I like to talk about the positives about it. And I love to help people get to it a little bit faster and certainly have the confidence to say, why can't I do this? So many other people do.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so Path to Practice Ownership. What was it that helped you realize that you had information to share with your colleagues to help them learn more about business?
Well, I sought other practice owners every time I was at something live. And this is pre-Zoom, right? And pre-this stuff where we can talk face-to-face across the country. So everything I went to, I looked for practice owners. Every conference, I just found them. I was like, you're a practice owner? Can we sit on the couch and talk? You know, sitting in the bar in the lobby at night. And what I found over the years, because I've been in practice ownership over 20 years, is that conversation changed. At the beginning, it was me asking and getting a bunch of information. And as time went on, it shifted where I was really giving a lot of information and kind of surprised at how they thought, oh my gosh, that's a great idea. And then they'd reach back out and say, I tried that and it worked. And so it was very organic at the beginning. And then several years ago, I had some back and neck pain that was going to limit what I was able to do as a large animal veterinarian, which was unfortunate because I love what I do. So it was going to limit how much clinical hours I could continue to do. And it was about the time that I was turning 50. And I thought, this is my midlife crisis. I'm going to go back to school and get my MBA. I can cash flow it right now. I don't have time. I'm still working 50-hour work weeks. I'm still running the practice. But I wanted it so badly. So I went back to get my MBA just because it was a bucket list thing, not because I thought I needed it as a practice owner. And about the second week into my MBA, my first course, I thought, oh my gosh, I have a lot of real world learned knowledge. And now I'm getting this book knowledge. If I put this together, I could make, well, first I was like cliff notes of these courses. So I started taking notes on a side paper of what about this applies directly to practice ownership that I should tell people about. And immediately that was like, I'm just going to record a course. Like that's the easy answer and put a bunch of applicable things to my practice. So I think the second week of my MBA course, I got the trademark for veterinary MBA because immediately I was like, I know what I'm going to do with my extra time, which of course you don't really have extra time, but I know where I'm going to spend my energy moving forward, even though I'm still in my practices. I still see some patients, but this has become my passion project.
So you mentioned one course for aspiring practice owners. What are a couple of your most popular courses for current practice owners?
I think the most important course is about vision, mission, and core values. It's not sexy. Nobody wants to sit and talk about it. They don't even want to pull theirs out of a desk drawer and look at it. But for me, I think that is the cornerstone of you have to have that locked in. And so that's the probably for me, I think the most important. But the outsourcing and delegation course is by far the most popular individual course. And then building your dream team, we've got a whole workshop on that where you go through hiring and attracting the right people and onboarding them correctly, and all filled with the mistakes that I made, right? I talk as much about what I did wrong as what I did right. And I get to infuse a lot of what I learned in that MBA into it. And I was really fortunate to pick a program that was a small business focus. So I didn't have to take any macroeconomics or international business. And I got to fill it with leadership communication, with family business courses. And so really relevant stuff to what I'm doing every day and what other practice owners are doing every day.
All right. That's awesome. You mentioned extra time, and you have five kiddos, you're a practice owner, and you do all of these other things, right? So what is your point of view on work-life balance? Do you think there is such a thing?
No, I hate that term. In fact, I shouldn't even share all this, but I just gave a list of terms that I don't want to use in my social media because I'm having some people help me with some stuff in social media. I do all my own posts. I do all of them all myself, but they're helping me with launching some stuff. And I said, these are the words that I do not want you to use ever. And that is work-life balance is by far like the top one. Here's my thoughts on it. I get what people are saying when they say they want work-life balance. I get that. But my thoughts are balance to me looks like a scale. And I think if you ask someone to write down on a piece of paper literally exactly what work-life balance looks like to them, whether it's equal energy in both or equal time in both, whatever it is, I don't even know because I think it's so amorphous. If you ask them to write it down, they really can't. And I've asked people, write down exactly what that looks like. And even if they kind of get something, that doesn't look like it next month. Their work-life balance, that same piece of paper doesn't apply next month. So to me, it's very amorphous and non-definable individually. And if people's goal is their happiness is dependent on attaining it, and it's not definable, then it's not attainable. And I think it makes people sad to think about. So that's why I really don't love it. I also love what I do. I love being a veterinarian. I love coaching practice owners. I love hanging out with my kids and my grandkids. I love vacationing. All these things don't have to be separate circles that can't touch. I love them all integrated. I have no problem reading blood work on a beach. That doesn't bother me at all. If I start to question myself while I'm on the beach, because I'm like, oh, I know somebody's handling it, but I really want to see what that blood work is on that kiddo because I care about them and I'm sitting on the beach. Who cares if I just look it up? Why should I then question, I don't have work-life balance. Look what I just did. I looked up blood. Now I'm just knocking myself down instead of saying, I love all these parts of my life and I love integrating them all together. I think integration makes more sense to me. And I'm not poo-pooing the concept. I recognize that. But I've also been somebody who has seasons of life like everyone else, where you're working a whole lot more and time-wise, spending more time working than you are maybe with your kids. And there's other seasons of life where you're spending more time with your kids and or your family or your hobbies or whatever. It just really changes so much. And you need to just shift your life as you need to shift it.
Okay. It's something that you can't define. And so, and also your point about if you're eating blood work on a beach, like that could be really cool, right? I mean, it could be. It's like, yeah, I'm on a beach and I'm doing this instead of in the clinic, right? So I think it just depends on your point of view. And other thing I'll throw in when I think about that is probably the more autonomy you have, either in your job or in your career in general, the happier you can probably be about that integration.
I agree. Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Yes. And as a practice owner, I have a lot more autonomy than an associate veterinarian would have, I'm sure. Yeah. And I get it. I think I work a lot with livestock vets because I am a livestock vet and some of them are solo practitioners. They're it. They're in a rural area. They are on 24/7. That is their life. I have done that. I did that for 8 months while my partner was having back surgery. There was nobody else seeing my patients for 8 months. Every day, there wasn't a day I didn't see them. Did I crave a day where I could go to Costco and not worry about having a frozen cart that I had to leave in the aisle? Yeah, I did. So I get that. But I also think that you can build the life that you want that makes sense, and then you can pivot as time goes on.
And that also makes me think about, because I have seen a couple of your Instagram posts that are burnout related. Folks that you are either mentoring or folks on your team, how do you recognize burnout and how do you help people with that?
I don't think it has a real good definition. I've tried to look it up. Here's how I define burnout: is being stuck in some state too long, right? Burnout doesn't happen. I'm not burnt out after a day that was hard. That doesn't make any sense. Burnout is when you're stuck somewhere really for a long time. And for me, with my team members, if I'm seeing some signs of problems, then I go to emotional differentiation, which is something I heard about a long time ago. And just, I can't believe I lived without for so long. And that's really deciding what is making me feel this way. So let's say I'm feeling whatever that is, right? My heart's racing. I'm trying not to use the words, but the feeling physiologically, I know this isn't good. So I sit back and say, what am I feeling? Am I stressed? To me, stress, there's something in the future that I'm worried about. Let's take out the word stress, anxiety, overwhelm. Let's just take them out. Let's say one of my things is I'm worried about something that hasn't happened yet. Well, then I need to figure out, do I really need to be worried? Is there something that I need to be doing differently so that I don't need to worry about it? Is it even under my control? Should I be worrying about stuff that's not in my control? Like, I'm very analytical. Okay, if I'm worried about something that's not that's in the future, there's a lot of things I can do. If my plate is too full and that's what's causing all this, then I need to outsource and delegate, right? I need to figure out what gets taken off. And it may be canceled. I may look and go, I'm going to say overwhelmed, but whatever the term is, I have too much on my schedule. I'm going to cancel some stuff. I'm going to call my friend and say, I'm just not able to meet this week. It might be stuff, whatever I take off, I take off. I might look and say, I've got a meeting with somebody. That can be an email. I'm changing that to an email. I think I rescheduled this podcast on a week that I was just too much is going on. And I think I did it the day before and I felt really bad because that's not how I like to do it. But I said, it's not going to work. It's not going to work this week. So that's one action that solves the problem. And those two things, going for a walk or going to therapy, doesn't help those two things. But then when you're, again, overwhelmed so much that you're confused, I don't even know why I feel this way. Okay, now I need to go for a walk or therapy, or I need to pull this apart, get a back up, whatever that looks like, and figure it out so that I can have an action plan to fix it. So I think being stuck in any of those emotional states for too long is, for me, what is burnout. Then you think, I can't ever get out of this. But there's action plans to get you out. If you can just say, what exactly am I concerned about? And what is the action that will decrease that for me? And that's how we live our lives now. Oh, my house, it's so crazy. And one of my favorite things to do is best case scenario, worst case scenario, most likely scenario. Just say it, define it. And almost always, worst case scenario isn't that bad. And you're like, oh. A great example of this is I was looking for a practice owner retreat, CE retreats. I've been looking for them. I've been begging all the people who do them to do one for practice owners, and there weren't. So I thought, why don't I just do my own? I'm going to do a live retreat. I don't know what I'm doing, but we're just going to do it. Well, it requires that you commit to a block of rooms. And in this case, it's at a dude ranch. We're doing this in Tucson, actually in November. I'm super excited. And I said to my family, okay, I'm blocking off 30 rooms. I can give up half of them in the middle, but worst case scenario, I have to pay for 15 rooms for 3 nights. We're going to have an incredible party. My team, we're either going to have a big team party out there. Family and friends are going to show up. Like, worst case scenario wasn't that bad. The dang thing sold out in 2.5 weeks. Best case scenario, I didn't even think it would sell out in 2.5 weeks. I just thought we'll fill all the rooms eventually and I'll be talking about it forever. So I think doing that made me take that leap because I went, wait, why am I stressing about this? Worst case scenario is not horrible. Yeah, it's money, but it would have been a really incredible party.
That would have been but it's going to be a different kind of party because you sold it out.
Yeah, so we're doing this live event and we actually got a bunch more rooms. So we're over 30 rooms now. Yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, and I like that. I like that advice about worst case scenario, best case scenario, and then most likely scenario. And I think that can be applied to so many things. You know, that can be applied to a major business decision. It can be applied to starting a business versus not. Because I talk with a lot of financial planning clients who, you know, they're thinking about, gosh, do I start that mobile clinic? Or do I make that leap into relief work? And they're trying to make this decision. Yeah. So I think that could be a really good framework to use.
I use it all the time with people trying to buy a practice. We sit down and we're going over it. I'm working with somebody right now who's trying to decide, does she buy into her practice? Does she buy the practice down the road or does she start her own practice? And we're going over literally best case, worst case, and really just leap, just take a leap. But you're right. It can be used in anything. I have a 3-year-old grandson who's not verbal. And so he was going to get tested for autism. And I sat with my son and my daughter-in-law the night before, and there was a little nervousness about what does this mean for the future? And again, we're getting anxious about something that hasn't happened yet. But I said, okay, let's just do best case, worst case, most likely scenario, right? Worst case scenario, the kid's pretty functional at 3. Worst case scenario is he's autistic and there's a lot of stuff we have to do for him. Best case scenario, he's not autistic. What's the most likely? And all of us said somewhere in the middle, he's autistic, but he's not. He's probably going to assimilate well with the world. So literally we used that for that scenario. And he went in and did a whole day of testing and is not autistic. Like, it was crazy to me. That wasn't even, like we said, best case scenario. We're like a little bit like, and it's good. But worst case scenario wasn't bad. And I think we all slept a lot better that night before the test. We use it in every part of our life.
Christine, you are just a wealth of knowledge. So what's the best way for our colleagues to get in touch with you?
Veterinary-MBA is the website and has most of the information. I just love chatting with people. So there's a contact thing on there. I read all my own emails. I look at all my own DMs. Veterinary_MBA is my Instagram account, but I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn and all those as well. So I just love chatting with other people who are going through this journey. I love chatting with students that are interested, managers that are struggling with pain points, practice owners that are struggling or thriving and just want to do better. I learn from everyone I talk to, and I have a lot of resources in an arsenal library that can address almost every pain point that's been brought forward to me.
All right. Well, cool. And we can put your social media accounts in the show notes to make it easier for folks to find you. Christine, that brings us to our last question. What is your best advice for our listeners?
Do things before you're ready. Don't wait to be ready. Don't wait to have it all figured out. Take more leaps of faith. That's just it. I talked to somebody yesterday who reached out in the DMs. I love chatting with people in the DMs, and they are thinking of expanding their clinic. It's a husband-wife team, both veterinarians, and it's really expensive, and they're very nervous about it. They have 2 exam rooms. I said, you needed to do this a long time ago.
Right.
You're doing it tomorrow. Tell them, whatever it costs, you need more than 2 exam rooms with 2 veterinarians. Period, end of story. It'll pay for itself. You're in the financial side, so I'm sure this is killing you, but I said, stop crunching all the numbers. Stop trying to make it justified. Just take the leap of faith, get the loan, and do the thing. You don't have to be ready, and you don't have to know all the outcomes, but you need more than 2 exam rooms, and they're busy as well.
Yeah. All right. Christine, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your advice and expertise.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. It's been way too long that we've talked about doing this, and I'm honored to be on your podcast.
Thanks so much for listening. My mission is to help you take control of your finances and build the life you envision. If you'd like to see how financial planning can support your goals, visit allvetfinancial.com and click the Book Now button to schedule a free intro call. Until next time, take care and continue your path to financial success. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered individualized financial advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, it should not be considered a recommendation or endorsement to buy or sell the investment. All investments involve risk. Past performance does not guarantee future results. You are encouraged to seek the advice of a financial professional before implementing any investment strategies discussed. Yay, compliance!